Oh, hey, it's me again, the Painting Podcast. I'm Jeremiah Polacek, your co-pilot on the pathway to becoming a better painter. Today we're going to be talking about mannerism. Coming off of our episode on the grotesque, we'll see some lines that connect both of these movements. We'll ask the questions, why did mannerist artists choose to distort proportion and perspective in their works? Can we see the reflections of mannerist art in other modern artistic movements? And how did mannerist artists challenge the artistic norms established during the Renaissance? How did they break these things that were so common in the Renaissance and forge their own path that was distinct in its own? We'll get into these topics and more, so stick around and find out. As we get into this episode, perhaps the best thing to do is to whip out your phone or Google this painting by Parmigianino, and it's called Madonna with Long Neck. And for those of you who can't, you know, pull up an image right now, I'm going to describe what we're seeing in this painting. Now, it's done by Parmigianino in 1505, and the most noticeable feature in this painting is this exaggerated length of the Madonna's neck. And that, of course, is what, you know, gives the painting its name. But when we look at her neck and her fingers, we can see that they're unnaturally elongated. And this, you know, gives it a sense of gracefulness as well as otherworldliness and a kind of strangeness. There's something unsettling about this painting, yet it's also very graceful and beautiful. And her pose is, you know, very serene, but it's also kind of unnatural. Her torso is tilted in this way that, you know, defies the way it would be depicted in the Renaissance. And of course, during the Renaissance, we would have artists that were transfixed on the idea of correctly portraying the human body. You know, we even have Da Vinci, of course, who is dissecting bodies and looking at the insertion points of certain muscles and documenting all of this along with notes. It's a very scientific approach to the human form and the human body. And when we're looking at Parmigianino, we begin to see a lot of these classical proportions are thrown out the window. And in the previous episode, which if you haven't listened to, I'd suggest go back and listen to that episode, but we talk about the grotesque and how we have these elongated forms that begin to bubble up into the work of people like Michelangelo and Raphael. And this relates to the discovery of the Domus Aurea and a lot of the paintings which were inside, and this was from the ancient Roman Empire. Coming back to Italy, let's just put a place and time on what we're going to be discussing today. Basically, we're talking about the 16th century and Italy and the rise of this form of what we call mannerism. Now, mannerism is also considered, you know, part of the High Renaissance. You know, the Renaissance spills over into it. There's no definitive beginning and ending point of any of these sorts of things. But you're stuck between the late High Renaissance and the Baroque era. And between these two time periods, we get mannerism. And the term mannerism comes from the Italian word maniera, which means style or manner. So when we're talking about mannerism, we're talking about generally the manner in which something is painted, right? So previously during the Renaissance, we would have this, you know, almost laser-like obsession with replicating nature and getting things right. And now we're giving a little bit more agency back to the artist to interpret. And it's about the manner of painting. It's very stylistic, right? It's less scientific and more stylistic. Perhaps that's a good way of relaying what exactly mannerism is. Now, there's a couple different characteristics of mannerism that we can use to identify paintings done in this particular way. As you've heard in other podcasts, I tend to not like the word style. So instead of that, I'll be saying this approach to painting or this manner of painting, of course. So the first and most noticeable, if you're looking at your phone and you're looking at that painting by Parmigianino, a Madonna with a long neck, the first thing you're going to notice is the long neck, right? So you're going to have these elongated proportions in many of these paintings. You know, figures in mannerist art are often depicted with these elongated bodies and limbs. And this creates, you know, this kind of grace, this kind of flow within the work, but it can also kind of unnaturally distort the appearance of things, right? So there's a bit of the grotesque in mannerism. There's a lot of the grotesque in mannerism because the grotesque is often about, you know, exaggerating forms and elongating them in your own way. Another thing about mannerism is that they have these complex compositions. And what I mean by that is if we look at a lot of the Renaissance painting, there's a lot of balance and harmony, right? In mannerist works, there's not a lot of balance or harmony. You know, there's often these very twisted poses. The people are crowded together into the space. And there's this kind of unusual play with space and the configurations which these people and, of course, the tapestry is all woven together within this painting. Another thing is that there's a lot of, we don't care about naturalism as much in mannerist works, right? There's an emphasis on a sort of artificiality within these works. So mannerism, you know, tends to like this sort of artificial elegance and sophistication rather than this realistic, idealized beauty that we would see in a lot of Renaissance art, right? So the results of this would be scenes and figures that can appear to be very oddly proportioned. You know, in some instances, we could even say they're abstracted completely. Because with painting, when we're creating a painting, we're always kind of creating some sort of abstraction because we have to take the 3D world and put it onto a two-dimensional plane, right? So in that process, there's always going to be a bit of abstraction. But of course, we can also think about a painting, you know, like a window. And if we're somebody like Albrecht Dürer and we're painting a rabbit, we want that rabbit to look like a rabbit. We don't want that rabbit's ears to be, you know, unnaturally elongated. There's this focus on naturalism within the art, right? And in mannerist works, this all goes out the window, and we're playing a lot more with proportion and abstraction immediately. And that raises some interesting questions about painting and what it means to make a photorealistic work and what it means to make an abstracted work. Another thing about mannerist works that sets them apart is that the colors are going to become even more vivid, right? So in the Renaissance, we go pre-Renaissance, and we see a lot of more subtle, toned-down color palettes. The Renaissance turns that up quite a bit with people like Michelangelo, and like I discussed previously, especially after the Restoration, works like the Sistine Chapel, we see that these colors are really bright, Disney-like colors. And mannerism, you know, jumps off of this tradition and creates works with even more vivid colors. So it starts becoming more about color rather than subject matter in a lot of ways. So when we look at this painting, Madonna with a long neck, we can start to think about, okay, who is important here? Who are we really exalting? And we can say this about any sort of artist from a lot of time periods, but within mannerist works, we can think about this Madonna painting. In this painting, who is important? It's Parmigianino. It's not necessarily Madonna as much. He's really beginning to speak about his approach to painting and his vision of the world. And another thing that sets these apart is who are these paintings actually for? So with mannerism, we begin to start experimenting with symbolism within painting, and these symbols themselves begin to tell a broader story of what is occurring. So in this painting, to the left, we see this series of angels that are looking at Mary and Jesus nicely sitting twistily on this chair. But behind her, we see this solid column. And that's not a mistake that, you know, you would put this sort of architectural element behind her. And if we start thinking about what does this column represent, it's most likely some sort of strength and stability. And underneath the column, we see a figure, a smaller figure, and it's unsure who this person is, but it could be a prophet, it could be a saint, it could be somebody just witnessing the event that is unfolding at that moment. But this figure is still done in kind of a sketchy manner, and it's uncertain whether or not perhaps Parmigianino died before the end of this painting. He just didn't have time to finish it. But also treating the figure in this kind of sketchy way while, you know, just rendering the rest of the painting in the foreground, it kind of pushes it back into the background as well. But regardless of that, it brings up this idea of hiding stuff in paintings. And we do this in the Renaissance too, right? Hiding symbols in paintings or trying to convey a certain subject or a certain idea through the use of different symbols in paintings. Of course, this would be popularized by movies like The Da Vinci Code, that if one looks at all these paintings in the right way, they can discover some sort of higher ultimate truth. And a lot of people still think about painting in that way. You'd be surprised how many people and how many students I get that still think about painting as a sort of game where you hide things. And I'm not sure if it comes from the Da Vinci Code itself or, you know, what exactly are the origins of this desire to hide things. Perhaps it's coming through abstraction and the, you know, the complete obliteration of all these sort of symbols that creates a desire for people to have their own secret language embedded within paintings. But mannerism does do that. Okay, that's actually happening within mannerist works. So the first thing we want to think about when we think about symbolism and trying to read this painting is, what's the point of giving Madonna this long neck and these flowing limbs? What's the point of making baby Jesus so huge? Like, he's clearly not a baby, right? And first of all, you know, the elongation of Madonna's neck and her, you know, arms and legs could be seen as symbolic in and of itself. And this could, you know, first be interpreted as some sort of symbol of grace and beauty. But more importantly, this grace and beauty transcends this earthly realism. This painting is going to point more towards heaven, you know, or the divine. So an interesting question in and of itself is, how should you depict the Madonna? How are you supposed to paint her? And the way the mannerists approached this type of subject was to convey the idea that she's definitely not of this world. She's not similar to the Albrecht Dürer rabbit, where we're focused on proportion and these sort of things. She comes from somewhere else. And the person, Jesus, who she's holding in her arms, of course, also comes from somewhere else. We're supposed to be, you know, seeing him as somebody who's already mature. He's not just a cute little baby. Oh, look at little baby Jesus. No, this is a serious baby, right? With big implications for centuries and millennia to come. So the first thing we're talking about here, if we're talking about it from a painterly perspective, what we're talking about is scale, right? What is the scale of the Madonna? What is the scale of Jesus? And simply put, when we make stuff bigger, it becomes more important. So we see the angels to the left of the Madonna here, and they're kind of small. They're diminutive little angels to her left. And as I said before, baby Jesus is big, which kind of conveys that he is larger than life. He's not of this world. But by making him big, he also becomes more of the focus of the painting, right? So we emphasize scale in paintings, if we're going to communicate visually, we make things bigger that are more important in the painting and say more about the subject that we want to say. If this was a painting of Madonna and Jesus, and they're just over there in the corner, and there's a giant goat, you know, eating some grass in the foreground that, you know, is much larger, that would be a different approach to using scale to convey a completely different message. And there's something else, just from a painterly perspective, that we can look at in this painting, and that's the colors, right? So Mary is typically shown as wearing blue, which is, you know, associated with royalty and the divine for numerous reasons, one of which is simply because it was harder to get that color. It's hard to, you know, get a pigment to make a beautiful purple or make a beautiful blue back in the day. It was a lot easier to, you know, you had a lot more access to earth tones than some sort of beautiful blue like we see represented here. So Mary, of course, is representing this like regality and the divine in her representation, and this is illustrated through the use of those colors. Now, behind Madonna, we see this burgundy red. We see a blood red right behind the Madonna. And this has been up for different interpretations, of course, as well. But of course, we can also think of the blood of Jesus and how that's important to Christianity, obviously. And when we look at Jesus himself and how he's depicted within this painting, is he asleep or is he dead, right? Where we could be giving... We know all these dead paintings of the Madonna or Mary holding a dead Jesus. We know that as a subject already. It's been burned into our brain for centuries at this point. So when we see a Madonna holding a baby, the you know, it's not curled up tight and, you know, sleeping nicely. It's the Jesus's body is kind of sprawled out. And one could interpret this to mean that it's alluding to the eventual death of Jesus himself. And so in some ways, we're seeing both the baby Jesus as well as the dead Jesus in this painting. So let's fast forward about 15 years into the future, and there's a painter working in Florence, right? So Parmigianino is working in Parma, and yes, that is where Parmesan cheese comes from. But we go to Florence, and here we have a young painter named Jacopo Pontormo, who is working in Florence. And he is also carrying the torch of Mannerist paintings, and he's making multiple paintings of Mary as well. So if you want to check out the painting we're about to get into, it's called The Visitation by Pontormo. And in this painting, we are witnessing this moment, which is an encounter between two women at the center of the canvas. There's also two figures behind them, which we'll get into in a moment. But the two people in this painting are Mary and her cousin Elizabeth, and they're both pregnant, and they're greeting each other with these outstretched hands in this quiet street, kind of a nondescript place. And the composition itself is very intimate, right? They're very close to each other physically, but a lot of the architectural elements in the background, they are done in very, very subdued colors, whereas Mary and Elizabeth have these beautiful, bright pinks and blues that make them all the more important, right? And this creates this close, personal scene based on this moment. And of course, Mary and her cousin Elizabeth, you know, one reason why they're having this moment together, it's not just because they're pregnant, it's because they're both divinely pregnant, because Elizabeth would give birth to John the Baptist. So they're both having this otherworldly moment, and Pontormo is painting the moment at which they meet. Now, if we get into the manner in which this is painted, we can see that the figures themselves are also rendered with these elongated and graceful limbs, and they're draped in these flowing robes that kind of enhances this delicate and kind of, I guess you could say, almost weightless. It's almost like they're floating within the scene. And Mary's is dressed in this bright orange, yellowish robe, while Elizabeth has this deep, rosy pink color. And as I said before, both of these garments give us this strong visual contrast against this muted background. So talking about it strictly from a painterly perspective, when you have muted colors like blue, they tend to want to recede in space. They want to go back farther in space. Oftentimes we'll associate cooler colors with those farther away. It's like when we're looking at a mountains on the horizon, there's this misty blueness, right, in the background. We push those things back in the background. We give Mary this bright yellow robe and Elizabeth this rosy pink robe, and they become front and center within the foreground of this painting. Now, there's also this mood that we have in the painting. There's this quietness that we have in the main painting. There's a mutual understanding between these two subjects. You know, there's a physical closeness of these figures and their interconnected gestures that they're making. But there's also an intensity in their gaze upon one each other. And this highlights the significance of this meeting itself, this moment in time that we are witnessing. But somebody else is there witnessing the event as well. It's these two figures that are located behind Mary and Elizabeth. And there is some discussion about who these figures are supposed to be and what they represent. And one common interpretation is that these figures are, maybe they're just witnesses or bystanders. They're just normal people that see this event, and they're being given the knowledge of this event to tell others, people in the community, right, that they're in. And their presence could, you know, underscore, you know, the significance of Mary's and Elizabeth's meeting together and providing this human context to the divine. So we have the divine, then we have the normal people witnessing it, much like we are the viewers looking at this painting and witnessing the scene as well. There's also the idea that there's these figures symbolize women from different ages or states of life. And this would kind of reflect the universal significance of this event across different generations and different, you know, people within the community. They could essentially be seen as representing the past and the future. Another possibility is that they're saints, right? We see saints all the time in all sorts of paintings. So these figures could simply be saints, a representation of a saint or an allegorical figure of virtue or something like this, right? So we have, but essentially at the same time, we have one old woman and one young woman within this painting. So we can read into that what is painted in a variety of ways. But let's think about how it's painted as well, since we're really focused on mannerism for the purposes of this podcast. You know, the medium that it's painted in is oil on wood, which is a relatively, you know, it's established at this point, but it's still new. And the technique involved would be glazing, right? So that's when you put down a layer of paint and then you use a transparent layer on top of it, you know, a thin transparent layer on top of it, and that creates this glowing type of color that we see. And of course, Pontormo would be using these brilliant pastel colors. So we don't just take those straight out of the tube and plop them onto our canvas. Oftentimes, we're doing an underpainting, like a grisaille, that's the word for it, which just means a black and white painting, or a painting in burnt sienna in another color. So you have this underpainting, and then you're slowly glazing your color on top of it, slowly pushing some of your darks a little bit darker and making your lights a little bit lighter. Because every time you glaze, your darks get a little bit lighter and your lights get a little bit darker, right? So there's a sort of nuance and time involved in creating a painting like this. It takes months and months, if not years. I think this painting took about 2 years to make. So it takes a lot of time just to let these different layers dry. So when you put down a layer, you're pretty committed to it because you've got to, you know, put the next layer on that is going to communicate successfully with what is painted underneath it. We also can think about the figure composition itself within this painting. And once again, the figures are elongated and positioned in close proximity to one another. And think about for a moment, we just got into the story about who these people are and what is happening in this scene, but also consider how are these figures painted and how does that communicate what is happening in the scene? How does it reflect what's happening more broadly within Christianity within Italy at the time? And that's when we find artists that have this unbelievable ability to resonate with a lot of different touchstones that are happening within religion, that are happening within philosophy, that are happening within science. And artists have this ability to bring all these different disciplines together and create an artifact that can encapsulate this time period. And that's something we see within this Pontormo painting and how he painted it, how he chose the colors for this painting, right? And if we're looking at that, what is happening in around 1518 at the time, that would be a contentious issue. And that would, of course, be the Protestant Reformation. So Catholicism is facing an onslaught of new theological problems that they have to contend with. And, you know, I'll get into a little bit of the differences between Pontormo and a more Protestant reform-minded vision. But particularly with Pontormo and Mannerism itself, we're seeing this sort of emotional intensity that is exemplified within paintings, right? The figures are in these close, intimate settings, and they're having these divine interactions. They're not us, like I said. Maybe they're the witnesses in the background, but they're not like us, right? They're a divine thing that is happening. And there's this beautiful fabric that is whirling around them and giving them this sense of otherworldliness, right? There's this emphasis that's very Catholic at the time. It's an emphasis on mystery and the sanctity of biblical events. And it's portraying them as these profound, transcendental experiences. So Catholic art of this period, including Pontormo, often would utilize this iconography and symbolism that would reinforce the faith within viewers, right? So art itself served as this vehicle for spiritual engagement, and this reflected the church's view of visual imagery, right? So it was a tool that you could cultivate a certain type of religious sentiment and following or adherence to within the church doctrines themselves. Now, Pontormo's Mannerist approach to painting had these elongated figures, right? It has these unusual spatial configurations, these Disney colors that are super loud and pushing themselves right to the front of the painting. And this creates this sense of otherworldliness, like I talked about. And it also has this drama within it, right? So this style is indicative of this refinement of religious art that would be encouraged by the Catholic Church to evoke this type of emotional response within the people who are viewing it, which hopefully are Catholics, right? Now, the Protestant would be a more reform-minded vision, and they would focus more on simplicity, right? So this is a stark contrast to the lavish way that Pontormo would create a painting, the brilliant colors which are used, everything else that is around it. And the Protestants would criticize Catholic art for using this type of lavish religious iconography within their works. You know, they wanted, their criticism was that they saw this as a form of idolatry, almost. Not almost, they did. It was viewed as idolatry within the Catholic Church. So this would be criticized by them. And the art that they would create would be more, you know, straightforward, less ornamental. What are these Italians doing with all this opera and all this ornamentation? And when we talked about the grotesque in our previous episode, you know, there, it's just decorate. It's almost like decoration for decoration's sake. And the decorations themselves become the people within the paintings. And that's something the Protestants wouldn't necessarily like. The subject matter in Protestant art would shift more towards everyday life and community, and there'd be fewer depictions of saints and these types of scenes that we're seeing in the Pontormo painting, right? So that's the big difference between mannerism and a Protestant painter such as Lucas Cranach the Elder. You could look at some of his works if you want to see some a good contrast against this Pontormo. But essentially, you know, these more Protestant reform-minded paintings are going to use clearer, straightforward imagery to communicate the theological message, right? There's less stylized stuff going on. We want to just tell the story in a straightforward manner. We don't need all this drama. We don't need all this emotional intensity and complexity seen in mannerist art. We want to see color and detail that serves the purpose of illustrating these theological concepts clearly and directly. And there's less interpretation in some ways for this artistic vision bursting out onto the canvas. And of course, as a painter myself, I can't help but just be more seducted by Pontormo's approach, right? As somebody who loves painting and loves artists making and fulfilling their own unique personal vision, I can't help but just be absolutely on Team Pontormo. Not to throw Lucas Cranach the Elder under the bus, but we do see a different approach in mannerism, and I hope that by listening to this podcast, you learned a little bit more about what it means to create mannerist paintings and what caused mannerism to break a little bit from the Renaissance, and also how does mannerism portray the Catholic vision of the world around 1520 or so in Italy, and how do we contrast that against the Protestant Reformation at the time, which is also occurring and creating all sorts of turmoil all throughout Europe. If you're into this sort of thing, head on over to oco.academy, which is my tiny little art school in Prague, where you can take classes with me and get individual guidance on how to develop your own artistic vision of the world through painting. Head on over to oco.academy and learn more about that right now. Thanks a lot for listening. Don't forget to follow, subscribe, click like, do all those sorts of things that help me out in the algorithm. And until next time, happy painting.